I honestly don't see any way of avoiding the imminent coronation of King Charles III. It's going to happen on Saturday. And it is a big deal. I know there are... Maybe the population is split into monarchists, republicans, and those that don't really care. Maybe it's a three-way split. But it provokes debate. And I suppose it comes down to whether or not it matters. Does it matter if the king is crowned? Does it matter if we have a king or not? My ire was inflamed this week by the news that, as an innovation, the Archbishop of Canterbury invites, that's the word they're using, invites us plebs to swear allegiance to King Charles III. Now this has never happened before. They used to have, they've traditionally had, a kind of a pledge of allegiance by the peers of the realm. You know, the great and the good, the lords and ladies go down on their knees in front of the monarch and pledge allegiance to him or her. This time, the Archbishop of Canterbury, God bless him, has come up with what's being called the homage of the people. And as described, the notion is that at some point during the coronation service, the Archbishop will appeal to the general public in the church and in the wider realm to stand in their living rooms or wherever they happen to be and trot out an oath of allegiance. He's describing it as a great cry around the nation and around the world of the support for our king. Now, this, I think, is the most tin-eared misreading of the room, to use modern parlance. I cannot believe that the Archbishop of Canterbury or anybody else would think that asking the people, after the three dreadful years just passed, to prioritise an oath of allegiance to the king, that anyone thought that was a good idea, is beyond me. And it must surely have been run past King Charles III, or else it wouldn't be happening. So he must think it's a good idea too. And I think it's appalling. But it's not just about the homage of the people, so-called. As I say, these past 3 years, from the advent of the pandemic forward, have been years like no others for most people alive today. People of a certain advanced age can remember war and other horrors, but for most people alive, the last 3 years have changed everything. You know, they have altered the very fabric of society, and people have been put through so much. There's the practicalities, like the cost of lockdown, the catastrophic damage that was inflicted upon business and therefore on the economy. There's the emotional and physical hit of the pandemic, the consequences of lockdown, the isolation of lockdown, the shutting of schools, the shutting of clubs and theatres and restaurants and shops and all of the rest of it. UK living standards are as low or lower than they have been since the 1950s. You know, dying people are on waiting lists for cancer treatment and all of the rest of it. I've looked at figures like 1 in 9 of the population are on the waiting list for some or other treatment for their failing health. And I think about that context and wonder, open-mouthed, that King Charles is taking the steps that he's taking. And it's not just about the homage to the people. What really troubles me about Charles and makes me ask questions about the constitutional monarchy that apparently we live in is that he has supported net zero and all that it means for his subjects, which is to say zero carbon, which is to say the rapid withdrawal of fossil fuels and everything that goes along with Agenda 2030 or Agenda 25 or whatever notional date they've put on completing this revolution. What all of that means for Charles's subjects, I really think ought to make him think again. I mean, put quite simply, many, many of his subjects are choosing between eating and heating at a time while he continues to be supportive of the concept of net zero that's pushed by the World Economic Forum and the World Health Organization and the United Nations and all of the rest of it. He pushes the contentious politics of net zero. And millions of us don't agree with those politics. And therefore it is wrong for the constitutional monarch to pick a side. People are for, people are against. And the constitutional monarch should not be taking a side, which means by definition that he becomes an opponent to some part of his population. It's wrong. I say all the time, not just about Charles, all these people that are interfering with our lives at every level, what kind of cars we can drive, how we can heat our homes, whether we should eat meat or switch instead to plant-based diets and powder made from insects. All of these people that are pushing and coercing these novel approaches to how we live our lives, I say, who do they think they are? Who do these people think they are inviting themselves to interfere in our lives in the way that they do? I've said it before and I'll say it again. Net zero, which King Charles and others support, is a suicide note being written on behalf of millions, if not billions, of people. And people will die as a direct result of the proposed withdrawal of fossil fuels and this so-called switch to renewables and a whole other swathe of alternative ways of living. I mean, let's just look at fossil fuels for a minute. At least 80% of all the energy upon which we depend comes from fossil fuels. We're not adopting renewables. There's not a naturally inclined switch. We're being coerced. We're being left with no option but to accept energy from renewables. And renewables don't offer an alternative to fossil fuels. Not at all. They certainly don't at the moment. And no rational mind thinks that they will offer that alternative at any time in the foreseeable future. I could be wrong, but I still think we're supposed to accept that nuclear is off the table as well, because the dominant green groups don't like nuclear either. We're in a situation globally where we need more energy and not less. This is not the time to have less energy. There are something like 3 billion people on the planet at the moment who have access to less electricity at any given moment than we here in the West require to run a fridge freezer. Billions of people are in that level of energy poverty. And in that context, to be contemplating taking away fossil fuels, which provide 80% or more of the energy that is presently available, that's why I describe that as a suicide note being written on behalf of those people. People who don't have access to cheap, available, reliable energy live miserable lives. There's no two ways about it. If you don't have access to energy you can afford, that you can rely upon, and that is readily accessible, you live a hungry, miserable, small life. We hear all the time about it being done in the name of stopping climate change. You cannot stop climate changing. Climate changes, that's what climate does. But there is no climate crisis. Now, that's my opinion. You can challenge that if you want, but I say there is no climate crisis. But it changes. The climate changes. And as it changes, it's more energy and not less energy that will enable the poorest billions on the planet to cope with changes. The volume of people dying every year on account of extreme weather events has been reduced by 99% in the last century. And that reduction has been driven by and made possible by fossil fuels. That's what made the difference. You know, on every continent on Earth, most people who die on account of the weather die of cold and not of heat. 90-odd percent more die of cold than die of heat. It's fossil fuels that provide the energy that let people be warm when it's cold and that provide the air conditioning that keeps people cool when it's too hot. And if we take away fossil fuels when there is no viable alternative, and there is no viable alternative at the moment, then people will die. That's all there is to it. There won't be a tree left on the planet, because if billions of people have no access to an energy supply beyond wood for heating and cooking, then they'll cut down all the trees. Now, I don't know how green that's supposed to look. I say that renewables are a con, they're subsidised to the hilt, and we're being coerced into doing things that will only make life harder, colder and hungrier. People aren't adopting renewables in that way that people go for the better option. You know, we used to just burn wood. That's how everybody cooked and heated. And then coal was made available. People switched to coal because it was better. It was more accessible. There was more of it. It provided more energy, per, you know, pound for pound. And then everything else came as well. Oil, the rest of the fossil fuels. And people adopted those alternatives because they were better. We're not adopting renewables because they're better. We're being coerced into accepting renewables because they're taking away the better option, which is fossil fuels. King Charles, right? You know, up until he became king, he was the Prince of Wales, and the bulk of his income came from the Duchy of Cornwall. Okay, and now I know that most of the estates, it's hundreds of square kilometres of territory, and most of it's not in Cornwall, but some of it is in Cornwall. And the Duchy of Cornwall is rooted in Cornwall for obvious reasons. And it, now that he's become king, that £1.2 billion source of wealth has gone to Prince William. Because that's the way it works. It goes to the elder heir of the monarch, the Duchy of Cornwall. So it's William's now to do with what he will, and time will tell. But let's look at Cornwall, you know, from which Charles drew his income until he became king. There was a report, I found a report online, it was called A Basic Income for Cornwall, and it was really a call for, you know, a universal basic income for the people of Cornwall to help them live better lives. And it was by an independent think tank called Autonomy. It was done by researchers at the University of Exeter's Penryn campus. And what did it find? Well, Cornwall is one of the most disadvantaged regions of the UK, with high rates of poverty, inequality and insecure work. It's been hit hard by COVID, the COVID pandemic, with the lockdown exposing the county's over-reliance on the visitor economy, that's tourists. According to official government figures, 17 of Cornwall's districts rank among the UK's 10% most deprived in the country. And 1 in 10 Cornish residents is worried about not having enough food to eat. 1 in 10. What I'm saying is, I would like to hear King Charles speak and be heard to empathise with and sympathise with, for example, the plight of the people of Cornwall. But on a broader note, I would like a meaningful monarch at such a time, rather than waiting on the people of the country to swear an oath of allegiance to him, I would like to hear him say something about how he understands and feels sad about how much so many people have suffered on account of ruinous policies that were applied by the government during the past 3 years. Their policies caused nothing but harm. Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly, of which, you know, the Scilly Isles are a part of it, have one of the highest suicide rates in England and a higher than average rate of self-harm. How can those two contrasts go hand in hand? How can any monarch be presiding over that kind of suffering and simultaneously, you know, as soon as his bottom is on the throne, expect the people to stand as one and pledge allegiance to him and to his heirs, and to hope that he lives forever? Because that is the wording of the oath that's being offered to the people. There's also a 2021 study by the University of Sheffield, which found that 3.87% of adults suffer from hunger in Cornwall, 9.5% struggle to access food, and 11.1% are worried about not having enough food. And that's running side by side with the notion that we're going to spend £250 million crowning King Charles. £250 million is going to be spent on that jolly. And I say again, do we live in a constitutional monarchy or not? That's the question for me. We're invited to understand that we live in a constitutional monarchy. And I say, we are entitled to know the truth. Do we really live in a constitutional monarchy? Because if we do, then, as I understand it, we are all sovereign. The king, the monarch, is the first sovereign. He's the first among equals. But we, like he, are sovereign individuals. And within a constitutional monarchy, ultimate power rests with us, the people, and not with Parliament. If you're in a situation where Parliament is sovereign and has the ultimate power, then that Parliament can legislate itself into a position from which it cannot be challenged. The ultimate power to challenge Parliament has to be ours, and is ours, under the terms of constitutional monarchy. It's therefore the obligation of a sworn constitutional monarch to preserve our sovereignty, to stand up in defence of our sovereignty, and indeed the sovereignty of Britain. Our constitutional monarch ought to be making it plain that the country of Britain and the people of Britain will not be subject to the overlordship of anyone else, any overseas power. But by any metric, King Charles is a globalist. He has said as much. He's supportive of the objectives of the World Economic Forum and the rest of those who are in favour of what can only really be described as a one-world government. So how does that sit with him being the constitutional monarch of Great Britain? So, I'll ask it again. Are we a constitutional monarchy or are we not? And if we are not, if the situation has changed and we are no longer living in a constitutional monarchy, then I say we need to have a conversation about what we are, rather than blowing millions on the crowning of a king. I think there's definitely distraction going on all around us. The last 3 years have been bad, but they were a consequence of, you know, generations of ultimately ruinous policies and behaviours. You know, the rich were always being made richer at the expense of the poor, and that process has simply accelerated to the point where it's been at fever pitch for the last 3 years, the biggest transfer of wealth from poor to rich in all of history. It feels like we're coming to the end of the viability of a system. It feels like the present system, the system under which we have lived for whatever decades, has run out of steam, and that the powers that be know that, and in the background they've laid the foundations for something new. But that we're being distracted all the time. We're being distracted from the realities and indeed the causes of the circumstances in which we find ourselves by all of the nonsense. You know, all of the, you know, being made to be distracted by notions that Britain's an institutionally racist country and that we are inherently bad by association with our heritage and our culture and our past. All of that is just divisive for the sake of being divisive. I feel the same way about what the likes of Mayor Sadiq Khan's up to in London with his ULEZ scheme and all of the rest of it. It's like, it feels as though he's just setting out to annoy people. You set people at each other's throats. We're fighting with one another about one issue after another because it suits the establishment that we are divided among ourselves rather than coming together and facing the root of the problem, which is the powers that be. And yes, we're being invited to look the other way by a red, white and blue ceremony. Lots of pomp and, you know, beautifully groomed horses and soldiers marching in perfect precision and rousing music and all of the rest of it, supposed to distract us for a day. And then some bright spark thinks, well, we're at it, let's get them to swear an oath of allegiance to the incoming monarch. It's distracting us from reality. And that, you've got to watch for that. you've got to pay attention. If they're trying to make us look the other way, then what are they making us look away from? I think we all know